This is All Things Git. I'm Edward Thompson. I'm really excited to talk to my guest today. Finally, we've been struggling to get this interview recorded due to some technical issues and some scheduling problems. But before we get started, I want to mention one thing that's coming up. It's the Git Merge 2018 conference, and it's coming to Barcelona on March 8th, 2018. If you're interested in Git, and if you're listening to me right now, then I've got to suspect that you are, then this is an amazing conference to learn what's going on in the Git communities. It's my favorite conference of the year, and I go to a lot of conferences. I think it's such a good conference that I want to do something a little bit special. All Things Git is going to give away a ticket to the conference to somebody who wants to go and who's from a minority that's generally underrepresented in software development. So if you're from an underrepresented minority and you want to go to the conference, tweet at us or send us a DM on Twitter. We're at All Things Git. We'll draw the winner at random in February. And I'm sorry, but this is just for the ticket. We can't provide travel. But I think it's a great opportunity, so hit us up. And with that out of the way, I'd like to introduce my guest today. It's Johan Abelskov. Hello, Johan.
Hi, and always nice to talk to you.
Thank you. Johan is a continuous delivery consultant at Pracma, specializing in automation, Git, and workflows. Johan has spent the last few years helping companies transition to Git, and he's taught Git on multiple continents to both software professionals and students. He's the maintainer of the Git Katas exercises. So, Johan, I mentioned that you're a continuous delivery consultant. Continuous delivery is a really hot topic these days, but what does it mean to be a continuous delivery consultant? What is it that you do on a day-to-day basis?
Basically, I am at clients, different companies, trying to help them become better at delivering software. And I do this without looking at or caring about their code, because a lot of these things, they're universal. It doesn't matter if you're trying to create a website that scales indefinitely, or if you're trying to create a physical product that contains some software and has test rigs that are in physical containers actually moving stuff in the real world. We all agree that we have to, as software professionals, work in a professional way. And all the agile practices, the DevOps practices, all the things that we're codifying all these years as a profession, we're helping our clients implement and understand.
Interesting. And I said that you work for Pracma. So what is Pracma, and where are you physically located? Because we've got a global audience. I don't know that everybody would know who Pracma is.
So in a global scale, Pracma is a tiny company with 50 employees based in Scandinavia. And we have offices in Denmark, Sweden, and Norway. And what we do is true consulting. We try to make our customers better. We try to deliver knowledge and make ourselves redundant from our customer perspective so we can help them doing more exciting stuff.
And so one of the things that you do particularly with Pracma is teaching Git. Why is Git important for continuous delivery and software delivery in general?
So Git is obviously a version control system. And in many cases, we say, well, it doesn't matter if you choose Git. It just matters that you have a good version control system. But in practice, that means Git, right? And when we're talking about migrating people to Git, the arguments against migrating to Git is we're not in Git right now, and we are using SVN, or it's expensive to transition. I have never once heard the argument, well, Git isn't the right place to be.
Interesting.
So basically, Git has a few nice properties that really helps us enable working efficiently in a continuous delivery world. Git is fast. Git is very fast. And especially when we consider the distributed part of Git, where you always work in your own local instance of Git with the full version history if you desire so, that means that we can distribute workloads very efficiently. That means that it's acceptable that we all the time have a workspace that's clean, so we know that it doesn't just work on my machine, because we establish a central place of truth. And that goes for everything from the actual code that we're doing to version controlled representation of our infrastructure through things like Docker or Packer or Kubernetes, all these awesome tools that help us make everything we do, even our environments, reproducible. So Git is important in that it enables us to do all these things that we have to do. I need to make sure that if I'm going to maintain a product for 15 years, which sounds insane if you're a greenfield company or a web company.
It's true, that does sound insane.
But in practice, then you can go outside in some desert and you can find pumps or cars that has software that has that age that you might need to maintain.
Sure. And even looking at it from my perspective, I mean, I work on Visual Studio Team Services that is now 10 years old.
Yes.
More than. Yeah, it came out first in 2005. So it's not just industrial stuff, although I suspect that gets a little bit revved differently. That's an interesting perspective. So now, and this may be bias, I feel like that Northern Europe and the Scandinavian countries see a lot more industrial automation than, say, the Americas do. In the US, we have nuclear reactors running software that hasn't been touched in 30 years, but I feel like there's more investment into industrial automation in the North. Do you see that of your clients, or is it mostly also just software companies building websites?
In Prague, we have a lot of industrial customers, almost solely. And they have the understanding that what they're trying to do in their production, having an assembly line, making sure that you catch defects early, all the lean principles, you eliminate waste, you eliminate rework, you defer decisions to the last responsible moment, you put configuration in as close to the customer as possible. All those efficiencies, they understand the value of, and they're proud of doing those things in their production line. So we can go to a client and say, well, the things that you are so proud of, that every time you get an interview, you have your assembly line in the background of the photo, right? Those things we would like to do for your software. And they say, oh, that sounds smart. They understand the business value in that.
Wow.
That's much harder in the financial industry, where we as a relatively young company, we can go and say, well, you should make your software this way and this way and this. It has these benefits, and you get more often met with a, you shouldn't tell us how to make software.
Right.
We know we have been making software for 50 years.
Right, right. Or, you know, some trading firm, they care about the opening bell and the closing bell. And, you know, that's sort of what defines their life cycle is the trades of a day or a quarter or whatever. That's really fascinating. I would have thought that the innovation is happening in Silicon Valley and everybody else is just kind of slow to catch up. But you're actually saying that what we might think of as some of these older, more established companies in fields that aren't strictly high tech, that you know are building actual widgets on an assembly line, might be more inclined to adopt continuous delivery and therefore Git. That's amazing.
You also have things like when you have such an expensive product, if it, for instance, is you have to assemble a complete truck, or you have software testing inside of something, of a car, of a self-driving car. If you have a product that's that complex and expensive, then the investment in virtualization and in simulation has a really high return on investment. So even in these old school, almost boring industries, there's a very clear business values in these very modern software practices.
So do you think that companies doing proper engineering, like that are engineering mechanical systems, also understand software engineering better than, say, just a couple of people starting up in a garage and just hacking on tools and just committing to master whenever they feel like it?
I will not go on record saying that.
Okay, I withdraw the question.
I think that a lot of companies, so we have a few different kinds of companies. There are those who have like the Netflixes and Facebooks who figured out that if they completely disrupted the way that they think about making software, then a whole new business opportunity, a new way of living with software has exploded and enabled completely new business areas. Then we have the companies that are slowly discovering that they are software companies.
Right.
Like the embedded industries, And in between, we have a lot of ordinary software companies building a desktop application to handle inventories or all those small tools or big tools and suites. People, ordinary software companies who just go to work and then they make an application and then they push that to master and burn some DVDs and then they have delivered their software. So we have these different types of companies thinking about software, and some of them have identity crisis. Because, well, we are a windmill company. Why do we need software developers, right? That's not our core business.
Sure.
So that forces them to think about how do we handle software? What is software? How do we just think about the software? And that's the same thing that happens in these very high-profile companies that go to conferences and demo their awesome tech. But we also have a lot of gray area in people making software but not really thinking about their craft.
And so you help people think about their craft.
Yes.
Okay, so let's switch gears away from from types of industries and industrial software.
From buzzwords.
Yeah. Tell me explicitly. So you actually walk into these organizations and teach developers how to use Git as part of their continuous delivery or DevOps sort of workflow. How is teaching Git to people?
It's hard, and it's always, you always learn something.
Really?
Yes. I have taught Git a lot, and both to, as you say, both to developers and to students, and with lots of experience, and people who love to learn about Git, and people who fight me at every step of the road. But one of the things is that it's always there. You won't teach Git one time without learning something, and I have them go through an exercise, and then at some point, they say, "Well, it did something that I didn't expect." Or why did it do this? Or why should I use the stage? And then I figure out something that if you give a path to git commit, it just creates a commit circumventing the stage.
Sure.
Which I didn't know because I tried to force people to use the stage. So
you just get people running git commit -am?
I'm having a crisis on exactly that command. I can't figure out if that's a good practice or if it's a bad practice.
Sure.
Because it requires that you know what's going on, and it just doesn't become like when you have to do a commit, then you do commit -am, which I think a lot of people actually learn when they first meet Git, right?
I think so too.
The way you do a commit by using git -am, and then you put in some text in the commit message, and that has a lot of weird consequences, right? One thing is that I think many modern software developers in Git, they don't know that you can have more than one line in your commit message or understand what is this staging.
Yeah, it's the staging area that I think a lot of people have trouble with.
For good and for bad, and when you only use git commit -am, then you get confused when you have a merge conflict.
Yes.
Because then you suddenly have to not only figure out this merge conflict and how to resolve that, but there's also things that you can mark in the stage, and what is the stage because I don't use the stage.
That is the worst time to have to learn a new piece of technology is when you're in the middle of a merge conflict.
Yes. That's also one of the reasons that I started using these the Git cutters that you mentioned. We have open sourced the exercises that we do for our Git teachings. And what these Git cutters is that they create a simple scenario, a Git repository, after running a script. And then it steps you through solving some task in that repository.
Give me an example.
Resolving a merge conflict.
Oh, okay. So you give a repository that somebody can clone.
Yes.
And then when they clone it, they're in the middle of a merge conflict, or do you walk them through the steps to a merge?
I give them a repository, and in there are perhaps 20 or 30 exercises or katas. And each represent a scenario or a lesson.
Okay.
And I run a script. I get a repository. And a set of commands that or steps that I need to go through. And I know through the magic of having prepared from home that if you do these steps, then you will end up in a merge conflict that you can resolve. And that allows you to practice the merge conflict.
Got it.
Or practice the interactive rebase. Or practice reordering your commits before you are in the situation that you actually need to do this. So it's about, I think, I can't remember. There's a guy who wrote a book called The Art of Learning. He was a chess player and then became a world champion of Tai Chi or some weird martial art. And one of the things that, he talks a lot about is numbers to leave numbers or form to forget form. And basically it's about you do these deliberate practices that you instinctively know how to do a rebase. So that means that you can think about the abstract usage of why are you doing the rebase or the scenario that you're trying to resolve, rather than having to figure out what are the tools, what are the minutiae of doing this action, of this scenario, because you have done it so many times that that's instinct to you, that's muscle memory.
You've done the katas so much. So yeah, kata comes from, I think, karate, which I think it means form, if I recall. So the idea is that, yeah, you know your tools inside and out. Now you're able to focus just on this particular conflict. You're able to focus just on the lines and figure out the logic that you need to solve. You don't have to worry about, do I run git add after I've resolved the conflict and then git commit? Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me.
It's the same way you can say that if you're coding in Visual Studio or BI or Emacs, it doesn't really matter. What matters is that you do your work in an editor that you know so well that you don't notice it.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. So you mentioned that you teach Git both to professional developers, you know, developers who have been working in the industry for years, as well as to students. Do you find that teaching Git to professionals is different than teaching Git to students? I mean, do you just whip out the katas and that's the easiest way to solve the problem? Or what kind of challenges do you see that are different between those two?
One of the biggest differences is, as in any teaching or really communication situation, is that it's about context.
Hmm.
The context of a student is very different from the context of a developer.
Sure.
And that both makes it easier and harder in different ways. If you're an experienced software developer, you know about issues with versions of different software. You have been in a situation where you ask yourself the question, where is the newest piece of my software? How do I obtain it? Or you've had a tester who says, I found these 8 bugs. And then you said, well, you should probably not have tested on that release.
Sure, that happens all the time.
Yes, and students, they say, well, that doesn't happen in the real life, right? No one is that stupid.
Oh.
Yes, they're so cute. On the other hand.
Idealism.
Yes, it's great. But on the other hand, it's great to have a teacher class. And we all know that Git is simple because it's just a directed acyclic graph.
Right.
And students, they say, yes, that's awesome. And then we have pointers. Yes, yes, it's easy. That generally is not the case when you're teaching experienced developers, because they accept that there is something that's called a graph and they probably learned about that at some point, but they don't use it every day.
That's right.
And then I think that we also see a lot of tool fatigue sometimes. Why should I learn another tool? Why should I learn Git? I'm just a software developer.
Sure.
I'm not a tools guy like you.
Sure. How is this actually going to help me?
Right. And that's one of the insights that I've also gotten from your podcast. I don't remember which of your guests as what, but that talked about prescriptive or descriptive teaching or communication.
Right. I think that was Sarah Ford.
That was so enlightening for me. So when people come and ask me about Git, and I will always say, yes, I will help you, then I tend to do the thing where I really enjoy Git and think it's excellent that we have all these different ways of manipulating our structure and doing the right thing in multiple ways. But with people, they have made a commit on the wrong branch, and then I go and then we draw, of course, graph and the pointers, and we go say, this is there, and then you can check this out, and you can reset this, or you can do a commit here, and then you can check out, or you can cherry pick this, or you can rebase this, or you can merge this. So go solve your problem. I tend to forget actually just solving the problem for them.
Right.
Because I just say, well, now you're enabled. And and so it needs to be the case, and it's boring and I hate it sometimes, but I need to remember all the time that I'm not teaching people Git for them to be Git experts. I'm teaching Git to make better software developers.
I think that's an interesting insight. I think I struggle with the same thing when I teach Git. Although, to be fair, I very rarely walk into a company and do it embedded like that. I tend to do it more at conferences where I can pretend that my goal really is to teach Git experts, but that's actually really good feedback for me too. So you actually get up on a whiteboard and draw like little nodes, little circular nodes and little arrows interconnecting them?
Yes, I have a longtime customer, and where I have a discussion when the arrows, they point in different directions when I'm discussing the workflow compared to how the project manager discusses the workflow. Because for him, time goes forward with the arrows. And for me, I have a parent point on my commit, so it obviously should point backwards in time.
Interesting. I was going to ask you that. I think everybody does it a different way. And so I've built now a couple of distributed version control systems. And one of the first things we argue about is which direction the arrows should point when we're talking about things on a whiteboard.
Mm, yes.
I actually favor the time goes forward approach myself, but I've gotten beat up on that by people. So it's an argument that never seems to end.
I also had an interesting discussion with either Catherine King or Cynthia Rich of GitHub discussing, do you draw your Git graph horizontally or vertically?
Oh. And?
Well, I tend to draw them like I see them in my log. So my oldest commit is in the bottom.
Whoa. I mean, look, I think that this is the right thing to do in terms of visualization, because you're reinforcing the thing that people will actually see when they run git log dash dash graph or whatever. But that's not the way I did either.
I think the most important point is to be consistent.
I agree. Interesting. Wow. So, so Johan, let me interrupt you real quick. I want to encourage our listeners to subscribe and to rate us in the iTunes store or in the Google store. If you rate us and you tweet at us, we're at All Things Git, then we'll send you some stickers with our logo. They look sharp on your laptop or the bumper of your car or wherever you want to put them. So rate us, won't you? So Johan, we were just talking about drawing graphs, and of course that leads to drawing little branch pointers. There's something I wanted to ask you. You mentioned you work at Pragma, so I know Pragma. I've worked with Pragma before. I think that they do great stuff. However, for the people that don't know Pragma, one of the things that you do is you have your own branching strategy, if you will. I don't really remember. Is it a riff on Git flow or GitHub flow?
It's a riff on the flow by Envy.
Okay. Yeah.
So what we are all about is automation. We want to think automation first, and we want things that are simple, because complex things are hard. So we've tried to make a branching strategy or a workflow that basically simplifies the Git flow by Envy. And we call it the Git flow with a PH.
Okay.
And basically what we want is that we take advantage of the fact that Git has the perfect branching model. It's so lightweight and fast and easy to work with. So what we're doing is that we are basically, we're always working on small feature branches, because we should do that. Trunk-based development is excellent.
Yes.
Small feature branches. And then when we want to deliver or integrate our change, our feature into the master branch, we push to our remote and we push to a temporary branch. So let's say I'm working on feature foo. I will push my changes, my feature branch, to ready/foo. Some sort of automation will then pick this up. It could be Jenkins, it could be Travis, it could be whatever. Do whatever testing is necessary. And if everything is good, then it will integrate those changes into master.
Whoa, interesting. So you've actually got Jenkins just like, is Jenkins watching for things in the ready namespace?
Yes.
So it'll, if it sees some new branch in ready/foo, it'll build it, it'll run the tests on it. And as soon as those tests pass, it integrates it right to master.
Yes.
So you don't use pull requests in this case.
Well, there's always an interesting discussion around pull requests.
Yes.
Because then your intuition is to say, well, it doesn't feel like it should just merge to master. And that's a reasonable intuition, because we generally work in different ways. And then we're going to say, why don't we want to integrate into master? Well, possibly the feature isn't needed in there yet, or we want some human to accept it, or we want to do a review.
Exactly.
And all those things would traditionally be in the pull request.
Yes.
I'm not adverse into saying, well, we could just use a pull request as our ready branch. So just have Jenkins auto-merge a pull request that builds. Then we're losing some of the things. Right, we're losing the control of what goes into master if it's a feature we don't need yet. But I'd say if you're working on a feature that you don't need yet, you're working on the wrong thing.
Yes.
So then we're left with the review. And I'm not saying that reviews are bad, but I'm saying that you should really consider why you're doing a review. Everything that we could have a computer review, code style, static analysis, code complexity, things like that, we should just do that as a part of our automated testing. So then we come back to things like architecture or the junior and senior software developers sitting together doing knowledge sharing. And those things I would rather have at the start of the development process.
Yes.
Because if I wait until my development is ready to be delivered to get told by a guy that's smarter than me that I did the architecture in a stupid way, then that's not very lean and that's not very agile.
No, that's true. You spent a lot of time just to get to that point.
So I'd say a lot of those things we would have more value in having in a pair programming session at the start of my task. So that's why I really like some GitHub person mentioned that you should start your pull request as a statement of intent. I'm going to work here on this.
Yes.
That gives complete transparency on what's going on. That allows you, as for instance, the libgit2 maintainer, you can see, okay, some guy's working on this, and I can see he has the right ideas, but the architecture is wrong or something is off compared to how you would have attacked it. So you can just say, well, consider this, and then the guy can deliver a much better thing for you to review when you get to take that in that change.
Yeah, I think I agree. I don't want people to be finding little bugs like equals versus double equals. You know, I've definitely missed this in a code review. I think that there's some example out there where people bike shed over a three-line pull request, a little change to a project. But, you know, when all of a sudden there are thousands of lines, it's easy to miss little things. And I've definitely missed a foo equals null versus foo equals equals null kind of bug and just, you know, totally accepted the pull request. And so I think you're absolutely right. Humans are not good at seeing that. Computers are good. So we should let the computer do it. We should run static code analysis. We should run, you know, as many tests and validation steps as we can to offload this from ourselves. Computers are supposed to make our lives easier, and we should let them. But at least my team at Microsoft, the VSTS team, is fairly distributed. We've got people in Redmond and Raleigh, North Carolina, and in India, and then, you know, scattered throughout, like myself. And so it's a lot easier in many ways to communicate over a pull request than it is to actually sit down and pair side by side.
But again, that pull request could be more long-lived then.
Yes. Yes.
Right. And it could, so the first commit your distributed colleague makes, he does the pull request.
Yes. Maybe with no code even. Just create a new branch from master. Here's a pull request. I haven't made any changes yet, but here's what I want
exactly.
to do.
Exactly. Also, one of the issues with code reviews are very hard. They're just hard to do. I haven't figured out the way to do code reviews really well. Someone could teach me that, I hope. But it's also about not disrupting your colleagues. We know that if you have to get an approved review for something at some point, then you will either harass your colleagues to the point of them not being able to do whatever they were doing, or you will just click OK on something you didn't review.
That's
the reality.
That is true. I don't know the secret either, especially as an open source maintainer.
I hope that we can do a thing like, say, all reviews or all pull requests that builds, they can possibly go to master or up next or whatever, a branch, potentially master. And each delivery will spawn a review that we can do asynchronously. And until all reviews have been done or things have been changed, then we don't release to production. So that could be a way to get the best of both worlds. But I haven't tried it in practice, so it's just an idea.
Well, if you try this and you have some great insights into modernizing the workflow, then we'll have you back on. Hey, so I've got a question for you. So changing gears a little bit, when you teach Git, do you teach the command line or do you teach GUIs?
I teach the command line. And there are many reflections in teaching Git. And you hit one of my reflections again, because I'm not sure it's the right way. I teach with the command line, some slides, and then always a whiteboard. There are many whiteboard magnets that I use as branch pointers, and the eraser I typically write head on, and then we have branch pointers and a head.
Whoa. I never thought about using magnets.
It's just pointers, right?
That's very clever.
So I got that from my colleague Jan, but that just works so well. A few different colors of magnets and markers, then you don't need slides for the command line, basically. Because if you can draw it, then you can solve it. But if the purpose is to make Git experts, I wouldn't hesitate saying that you need to learn the command line, because that's where you get exposed to what is actually happening. And sure. I still think that it's healthy for everyone to be able to do basic Git stuff in the command line, the same way that I think that you should be able to do basic math without a calculator.
Yep, agreed.
But that being said, if you're an engineer and you don't have your calculator, you will be much less efficient than if you have your calculator. So we return again to, are we making Git experts or are we making better software developers?
Yes.
So my homework is to learn more about the different integrations into Visual Studio, into Atom, into all sorts of different editors, because where we really should focus on at least the workflow-based stuff is in the context that the developer is in. And the context of the developer, unless they're crazy tool people like us, is not the command line.
No, I think you're absolutely right. And I think a lot of people, you know, become at home in their IDE because context switching is expensive, right? Even just opening a terminal window can be more expensive than just, you know, I still see my code now just at the bottom of my screen or over to the right or whatever. I see some Git operations, or maybe I see a little icon in the Solution Explorer that I'm always inside of. I'm very sympathetic to people who want their version control in their IDE or in their text editor.
Yes, again, it's about what are the problem that you're actually trying to solve. And the problem that you're trying to solve as a software developer never starts with, I'm trying to solve this Git problem.
No.
The problem is, I want to deliver my software, or I want to check out this earlier version.
Exactly. Yeah, I need to fix a bug in an older version. I want to push something new to production, et cetera, et cetera. It's totally true. And I at least tend to lose sight of that from time to time.
I instantly do that. Ask me a good question and I will lose sight of that.
Right. And I'd like to defend that by saying, well, now you can always solve this problem when it comes up in the future. I'm giving you the theoretical underpinnings. But when I took physics, it was all calculus, right? I hadn't taken calculus when I took physics. I don't know why they taught that out of order. I think it probably makes more sense to do it the other way, but that literally doesn't matter for this conversation. When I took physics, I hadn't taken calculus yet. And they were teaching me all these formulas and I was like, but why? And you can be totally functional calculating, I don't know, flow rates of fluids in and out of a closed container just with rote equations, not even understanding really why these things change the way they do.
Pattern matching is a good skill.
It totally is. And so you can be totally efficient. Now, I think that everybody should have calculus or DiffEQ to be able to calculate these things, but it's not really necessary.
One of the cool things that we at Pragma do is that we have figured out that all of our clients and ourselves, we don't have a pool of newly educated students that has the right profile in terms of what we do as a business, that is the tools and processes around developing software. So what do? You try to create them ourselves. So in collaboration with a few local universities, we have done a very intensive 4-day continuous delivery academy where we teach everything from agile processes to Docker and Git and Jenkins, like in a summer school format. And then we know that the good ones, we can either push to our customers or we can hire them ourselves.
Wow.
And that's been so much fun for us. And it has given some great colleagues. And we try to do this. We have done this 2 years at, I think, in 6 cities or something like that. And we will do a few more in 2018. And the thing that where you get people when they need to learn, when they need to have it as a part of their backbone of software development. Many people, they don't learn Git at the university. They just learn, well, you have a small project, so whatever.
Right. If that.
Yeah,
you know,
if that.
It could just be totally theoretical. Yeah,
yes. That's also, there are many computer scientists who can't develop software, myself included. But then they have a course, and then perhaps they will just learn to do commits and push and pull to master.
Right.
And we would like that when they get into the real world, where they statistically will be using Git, that they actually know Git.
That would be ideal.
So we both have done the Continuous Delivery Academy, and then we have done Git for Students, 12-hour course, 3 Wednesday nights.
Wow.
Just have a set of students and then do nothing but Git.
That's really cool. I think that's great that you're giving the practical software delivery tools to them, because in college, I wrote some code and I just threw it at the teacher. I certainly didn't deliver it to production, and I certainly didn't have to maintain it after that. And those are skills that people are not coming out of college with generally. So I think that that's really phenomenal.
So that's also one of the challenges, because then it becomes very hard to motivate why are all these things necessary. Because as I said, they haven't experienced all these pains.
Right.
For them, it has been very sufficient to have Dropbox. Now my software is version controlled.
That's not... that pains me. Oh, Dropbox. Can you even get history in Dropbox, or is it just like a network share? Do you still have to do like file.c, file.c.2, file.c. This is really the final one.
I have no idea, but I think that you might be able to do revisions. But I think if you can do revisions in something that's not version control for real, then you will end up with _final_draft.pdf just right. To be sure.
Oh, that pains me. But no, I think that that's really cool. I think some schools are doing more software engineering type courses. My father-in-law actually teaches at Naperville Central College in Naperville, Illinois, and he teaches, there's an honors course. And it's disappointing that this is the honors course and not, you know, standard. But the honors course is a full year, 2-semester course where students work together on a project and they deliver a project end to end to actual customers. They find customers in the community, they build software for them, and they are worried about A, hitting the requirements, taking the requirements from the customers and then delivering software that meets them, and iterating on them and delivering to production. And I think that that is something that's incredible, because most of us aren't going to go on to be PhDs and then postdocs and then professors in computer science. A lot of people going through the CS curriculum are going to be software engineers, and they don't get very much software engineering in a typical curriculum. So I think the Code Academy is an amazing addition. I just wish you offered it outside of the Scandics.
We'll talk. So you're a great speaker, and you have probably taught Git or version control to many people. How did you learn to teach?
I don't know. Actually, I really don't know. I've never really thought about it. My mom was a teacher. Her parents were both teachers. My uncle's a teacher. I think maybe it's in the blood, but I don't know. I don't know if I'm any good or not. That's the thing. I just enjoy doing it, and people keep letting me. So so thanks for the kind words, but I literally have no idea.
I think that's also a thing that's a big challenge for us tech people, because as consultants or as... you must be said to be a very, very high tier Git expert. So it's important how we communicate.
Yes.
And teaching is communicating, and how we communicate about these things, because it's all encompassing the world. So figuring out what vocabulary are we using when we're talking about Git? What are the ways that we can push the right knowledge, or figure out what's the right knowledge to push to our users? That's a challenge. I don't have a solution.
No, I don't.
I didn't learn to teach either. People tend to keep letting me do it, and I enjoy it, so thanks.
Yeah, exactly. I'm going to keep taking advantage of their generosity. But that's an interesting point you bring up. We have some standard vocabulary when it comes to Git, and I guess teaching Git, but maybe not enough. I mean, Git is completely unopinionated about the way you work. It gives you hundreds of ways to hang yourself, right? It gives you enough rope over and over and over again. Do we need better terminology in Git? Do we need better terminology when we're teaching Git? Should we standardize on these things? Or is it good enough to keep it the sort of wild west of there's more than one way to do it that we have
now? I think one of the lessons that I've learned is that when I get consulted as a Git expert, I need to have more of an opinion, because the people that are asking me for advice, they're actually asking me to have that opinion and to be responsible for that opinion. We're very much in the line of saying, I will enable you to make your own opinion, but I should be able to take some best practices and say, you probably want to do it this way. There are many things, and I will not this time ask you if merge or rebase is the best solution.
You beat me to the question.
Or if you should use many repositories or one repository. So we'll just do it easier. How do you spell Git?
Well, are we talking about Git the program or Git the sort of concept?
Yes.
So I spell it capital G, lowercase I, lowercase T for like Git, the community, the concept, the version control system. But the command line application, Git that Linus started and now Junio maintains is lowercase git. What it never is, never, is all caps.
Yes, I do the same thing. And if you go to the Git subreddit, that's exactly what it says. Just don't make it all capitals, then you're probably safe. But even things like that, that the Git community isn't just saying, just spell it lowercase, it's a command line tool, uppercase, it's a concept. These very specific scenarios where we don't have an opinion because there is no right way to do it in Git, or rather there are many right ways to do it. It's the Perl thought, right?
That's right. Yeah, that's Git does harken back to Perl in that regard for me, which is both great and, yes, very frustrating from time to time. I'm a big fan, but yeah, the number of times I have to listen to, well, should we merge or should we rebase? I want to cry sometimes.
Yes, so basically, we should just have an opinionated git.com. Please make it. And then we'll just, for each of these annoying questions, just say, well, you can do both, but probably you want to do this. That would be a great resource.
Will there be an opinionated git.com by the time this episode airs? Because if not, I will just let that slide. I'm not going to set it up.
Yes, it will be there. Let's break some eggs and make people angry.
Awesome.
I have one more fun question for you. Do you feel like Git is feature complete?
Do I feel like Git is feature complete? I think that this harkens back to being opinionated or not in some sense. So I think that there are two questions. One is a functional question. Could Git have more features? Yes. Will it have more features? Yes. Because the Git community is unopinionated and somebody's going to come up with some idea that they want that Git doesn't do today. No, Git is not feature complete. Here are things that I think would be interesting. revision numbers. This is, you know, hotly debated about whether we actually want revision numbers or not. I think that Git will someday have revision numbers. I think that Git will someday remember the original commits. I think that it would be really interesting once you've rewritten a commit to be able to look at the original commit that you've rewrote. I think that Git will someday track that information. But, you know, I could be wrong about these things.
I like the LaTeX version numbering that just close on close approximates pi because everything is...
Right.
It is feature complete. It just gets closer and closer to perfect.
That's right. One of Knuth's other tools, I think it's Metafont, is converging on E. Mm. So I think that's a good way to solve the problem. And I think that actually people might get more excited about it if your revision numbers weren't monotonically increasing, but they were instead converging on irrational numbers. I don't know. So that's a great question. I don't think Git is feature complete. I think that is probably mostly technically... it's not even technically complete. We're going to change the SHA algorithms. We're going to... No, that's... So these... Okay, I got to put this back to you. I've never thought about this before. I'll just say no, and we'll continue to see new things, but I don't know what they are. What about you? What do you think? Is Git feature complete?
I don't miss any features.
No, me neither.
I think that inevitably there will be some tool that pushes Git away.
Oh, yeah, I do.
And I'm not going to like it. And I will be the old grumpy guy saying, well, back in the days, Git was better. But there happens to be either a point where Git has transformed so much that it will be Git 2.0 in all the air quotes you can't see.
Yes.
Or that it will be better to say, well, let's draw a line in the sand here and start over based on the lessons that we've learned. And that might be the Git community, or that might be a secondary community that just says, well, basically, Git was great, but now we are more clever, so we are doing it this way. And one of the things that I worry about is Git is a very complex tool. So what would happen if, for instance, we removed everything about submodules? Just to say one also classic point of contention.
I think that's a good place to start.
So we just remove Git submodules. In the next major version, there are no submodules. Because then people, if they need them, they can either go to do some proper dependency management in other tools or build the workflows around which Git supports. For me, it's more about building workflows and tools that support that than adding features to Git. But I can't even compile the Git source code, so I'm probably the wrong person to be too opinionated about this.
Git compiles great as long as you're on Linux.
Well, it might be more of a skill issue. But I would just like, for my use case, I only need a few features. So let's remove all the rest of the features, right?
So yeah, for sure, there will be a new tool, a new version control system that at some point displaces Git. Maybe Monotone will rise up from the ashes.
I assume I missed a reference.
Oh, so Monotone actually greatly inspired Git. It was an early distributed version control system. It was built by a guy named Graydon Hoare. Graydon is one of these quiet geniuses that goes off and does a crazy amount of work that is crazily influential and probably doesn't get as much credit as he deserves. So he built Rust, for example, the Rust language. One of the things that he built before that was the Monotone version control system, which its design greatly inspired Git. And in fact, I think that there was some like bizarre set of circumstances and coincidences. Like Monotone was really interesting and Linus was looking at it, but it was really slow. Like it validated hashes on every operation or something. There was some decision that it made that made it generally inefficient, especially at the Linux kernel source code repository sizes. And so Linus, being impatient and wanting to move to a new version control system over the weekend, decided to build Git instead. And I think then Graydon came back from vacation and was like, wait, what happened? We could have just fixed that. But Monotone was a really interesting tool, and it sort of gets forgotten about in the history of Git. I feel like it was an immediate precursor to it, but I don't know. I wasn't really around for all of the history, like working on Git at the time. So I may be overstating its importance, but it generally gets ignored, and we should remember Monotone.
We should remember Monotone.
Anyway, that's my Monotone rant. I will rant about other distributed version control systems that nobody's heard of on other episodes. Well, Johan, it's been amazing talking to you. Thank you so much for coming on. And I'm glad that we finally sorted out all the technical issues. Thank you again for joining me.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to another episode of All Things Git. Please, again, subscribe and rate us on the iTunes Store and on the Google Play Store if you want stickers. Hit us up on Twitter. We're at All Things Git. We're also All Things Git on Facebook, and you can find us at allthingsgit.com. So again, thanks for listening.